Shout out to Claritin for supporting this episode and providing us with samples. In springtime, allergies can sometimes be my kryptonite. When my nose is plugged up and my eyes are watering, I feel like I struggle more to do the things I really enjoy. Making dinner, heading outside to get my sunlight before noon, and even hosting the show can be a bit more challenging. Luckily, for those of us who live with the symptoms of allergies, we can live Claritin Clear with Claritin D. This double-action combination of prescription-strength allergy medication and the best decongestant available relieves sneezing, a runny nose, itchy and watery eyes, an itchy nose and throat, and sinus congestion and pressure with ease. I've been taking Claritin D for my allergies for several years, and it's been an absolute life changer. My eyes aren't a constant, itchy, drippy faucet, my nose isn't running, and I can speak without feeling like something has jumped in my throat. And I love that Claritin D tackles nasal congestion caused by allergies or cold, and also relieves sinus congestion and pressure due to allergies. Ready to live life as if you don't have allergies? It's time to live Claritin Clear. Ask for Claritin D at your local pharmacy counter. You don't even need a prescription. Use as directed. All right. Welcome to the 1000 Hours Outside podcast. My name is Ginny Erich. I'm the founder of 1000 Hours Outside. And what a treat. We have Jack Carr here for you today. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. Great to talk to you.
Yeah, this is awesome. So let me just first start off by thanking you for your service to our country, 20 years in the Navy SEALs, and just so grateful for your service and know that it is utterly important for our freedoms and for all the things that we enjoy. So thank you.
Oh, I appreciate that. Yeah, I just flew back to San Diego a couple of days ago for a friend's retirement ceremony, and he did 33 years in the SEAL teams. And he's one of the first people that I met when I walked into my first SEAL team at SEAL Team 5 in 1997. And then he ended up being my troop chief, which is like the senior enlisted when we went to Iraq a few years back now. So I got to be there at his retirement ceremony, and it was like a huge reunion. So it was a lot.
I'll bet. That's incredible. Well, you have just built this empire, and it is incredible. 6 books, another book coming out that is nonfiction, which I'm excited to hear about, a television series on Amazon Prime that is the top streamed with Chris Pratt, and 6 book is coming out, Only the Dead. So I would love to start back in your childhood. I think that your story is such an interesting one because this got set in motion, this book here, and the television series and all of that got set in motion when you were 11 years old, inspired at 11, starting with Rambo and different books. So can you just tell us, both for the Navy SEALs and for becoming a writer, some of that childhood inspiration?
Yeah, I mean, it started very early for me. I wasn't one of those kids or adults that is constantly searching or unsure of what they want to do or anything like that. And I think a lot of it, the military side, I think was just in my blood from the get-go. And my grandfather, he was killed in World War II. He was a Marine Corsair pilot. So that was the plane that had the gull wings that would fold up, and so you could put them on aircraft carriers. So I grew up with his medals and his wings and pictures of him and his squadron, the silk maps that they used to give aviators back then. Because if you had a paper map and you went down in the water, it would just disintegrate. But a silk map just got wet, still works. So I had all those things. And then there was a TV show back then called Black Sheep Squadron, starring Robert Conrad, and he portrayed Pappy Boynton, who was a Marine Corps aviator who flew a Corsair. So my dad and I would watch that show together. I think I was catching an early syndication in the 80s because it came out in the late 70s. But that was that and other World War II movies essentially were our touch point to his father, my grandfather, because you couldn't just jump on Facebook and say, oh, let's see if there's a Facebook group of this squadron out there. Wow. Let me see if I can find someone who knows my dad or find someone who knows my grandfather. It was just guys got back from World War II and got back to work. So there wasn't any real connection unless your father made it home type of a thing. So I had that. So I knew I was going to join the military from a very early age. It was just, that's what I was going to do. And then at age 7, I found out about SEALs through an old black and white movie called The Frogmen. And I asked my dad, hey, who are these guys? And I think I was interrupting him during football. So he said, ask your mother. And my mom was and still is a librarian. So we went down to the local library and started researching about SEALs. And I found out about underwater demolition teams and then a little bit about what SEALs did in Vietnam. And essentially back then, this is early 80s, you could find the end of the internet because it was a library shelf. Mm-hmm. And once you got to the end of that shelf, it was like, okay, I've studied pretty much everything that I can find on special operations in Vietnam, not just SEALs, but special operations in general. And so I think it is. So no, I think at age 10 is when I start moving from like the young adult fiction into fiction. And by age 11, sixth grade, certainly I'm reading the same kind of books that my parents are reading. But my parents and my mom specifically really made reading a natural part of my life. So it wasn't something that was forced upon me, like, okay, you have to do 15 minutes of reading now. No, it was my parents read to me growing up. And then when I could read my own books, I started reading those. And it was just something that was very natural and something that I loved to do. So by age 11, I am certainly reading the same kind of books my parents are reading. And that's Tom Clancy, Hunt for Red October is out at that point. David Morrell, who created Rambo back in 1972 with First Blood, a book that has never been out of print. So I'm reading that. I find Brotherhood of the Rose by David Morrell. I find Charm School by Nelson DeMille. I find books by Louis L'Amour, by Stephen Hunter, by A.J. Quinnell, by J.C. Pollock, by all these guys who were essentially masters in the art of the story, of the thriller. And also around that same time, a little bit later, 1988, my mom introduces me to Joseph Campbell through a series of interviews he did with Bill Moyers on PBS called The Power of Myth. And I find out about Hero with a Thousand Faces, which is his seminal work. And then there was a couple books that came out based off those interviews he did with Bill Moyers called Power of Myth. The books were called that as well. But I remember him talking about how the hero's journey and this mythology around the hero influenced George Lucas with Star Wars. So I was enthralled by that. But I think I started applying that hero's journey to things that I read, to things that I watched, whether it was intentional or not. I just started doing that because it was such an impactful time in my childhood. So that's a very long way of me saying that that I knew I wanted to be a SEAL from a very early age, and then knew that I wanted to write books from a very early age. And in sixth grade, I read Most Dangerous Game, which is a short story by Richard Connell written in the 1920s. And I said, one day I'll write a thriller that pays tribute to this short story. And that was my third novel, Savage Son, which is actually the one I wanted to write first. But I knew that the characters weren't developed enough to explore the themes of Savage Son. I had to introduce those characters in The Terminal List, which is the first one. And I knew that one seemed to be the one that of all the different ideas that I had written down. And I had 6, 7, 8, 9 different ideas, like one page executive summaries written down, and then was deciding which one to go with for my first novel. And The Terminal List was clear that that was the one to start with, to introduce these characters with this hard-hitting theme of revenge without constraint. And then even at the end of that one, I still knew that the characters weren't ready for Savage Son, and I had to take James Reese on a journey of redemption, which I termed violent redemption. And then at the end of that, then I knew that the characters were ready for Savage Son. But it's really cool working on that, something that I thought about writing back in sixth grade. So, I feel very fortunate that I had this amazing foundation through reading from the fan perspective. I didn't go to school or I didn't read books and say, how do you do this? What are the steps to writing a book? Oh, okay. No, I just came at it from the fan perspective. And luckily, I read all those books through these eyes of, like, you know, a kid, of a young adult that didn't have the cynicism built up that sometimes comes with age and experience. I got to read them just pure, I guess is the way, better way to describe it. And so I just enjoyed being in those pages. There's magic in those pages. And I knew that one day I'd write the same type of thrillers. So that's what I'm doing.
Wow. What a thing. What a story. It came full circle, because then you had David Morrell on your podcast.
Yep. I was just talking to him, not yesterday, but 2 days ago. Actually, he just sent me books, Testament, unpublished prologues to his work, Testament. There's not very many of these in existence. And he just sent this the other day. It just arrived. And I'm really looking forward to reading this.
Unbelievable. You know, everyone has dreams, but then you did it. So, I mean, that is a really cool story. And I was wondering, in this book, in Only the Dead, when he goes to Andy's house, and this is a difference, this is a distinct difference, I think, between books that, you know, if you mainly have more of a male audience, it's like everyone's written with their last name. So is Andy, and then I don't know how you pronounce it, Danrab, but do you know in your mind how you pronounce all the last names?
No, because in my mind, I'm reading them, or I'm coming up with them, and I'm not verbalizing them. So there's a ton of names that I never hear until Ray Porter, the person who narrates my audiobooks, until he says them. There's a bunch of them that I don't know, because I'm just seeing them visually. And then when it comes time to say them, or in an interview, someone asks me how to pronounce something, and I'm like,
Ray will know.
Yeah, well, exactly. Sometimes what Ray says is different, that was kind of in my head. But even in your head, it's different than when you say it out loud.
Yeah, right. Okay, so he goes to Andy's house, and the place is filled with books. And I loved all of it. It was, the way that you word it, you say the furniture seemed to be arranged around the books rather than the other way around. He had this other house that was filled with books, and it just made me think, like, this is you. Is that how your life is?
If I was to pick this computer up and turn it right now, and I won't do it because it's semi-embarrassing, there are books stacked everywhere and there's piles of papers for research because I haven't yet cleaned up and reorganized since finishing the book that you have right there. So eventually I'll take a breath and kind of reshuffle here a little bit and get organized. But eventually I'm making a library in this other room here that'll be organized.
It'll overflow probably, just like this
Oh,
Andy character. I
yeah,
just
that's
love
right.
that. Well, so then you have, as an aside, you have fabulous book lists on your website. Now, I just offer parents listening, this podcast will come out about a month before Father's Day. You have your own book club that you run. And even within this book, it was book after book after book, even characters talking about the books that they had read. So real cool to see that and to have some different jumping off points so people can find your book list.
That's fun to do that, especially in the pages of a novel, just kind of give a tribute or a little nod to those who have influenced me along the way, because essentially I have this foundation that was built by these masters, and I'm building off that foundation, off their contributions. And my goal every time is to get better, each book, every sentence get better, but also move the genre forward, even if it's just by a degree, but add something to it so the people that come behind me will build on that foundation going forward. So
Yeah.
I love to work in authors or works that have influenced me into the actual storyline, and I got to do
Yes.
that this time. I do that in most of the books, but this time it's more direct. It's less just added in, and it's more woven in, if that makes sense. And it
Yeah.
really does impact the storyline a little bit. And then I talk about that at the end in my author's note as
Yeah.
well.
Yeah. And just interesting to be aware of all the different genres out there because then you're saying, well, you're looking around at Andy's house and he has biographies of statesmen, generals, intelligence officials, and then you talk about even the books that you use to research. So sometimes you look at someone who's 20 years in the Navy SEALs and think this is completely based off of experience, but you've also done extensive research on the books as well so that you learn a lot. I learned a lot, I'll tell you.
Thank you. Yeah, the last two books, or no, the last three to include this one, have been deep down the rabbit hole as far as research goes. And jumping back to books real quick, there was in the first novel in the Terminal List, I have a police officer going into my protagonist James Reese's house and looking around, and then he gets distracted by the bookshelves and wonder what kind of a guy has these kind of books, and pulls one off. But I list a few, and those are all books that have influenced me. And then when it came time to do the opening credits for the Terminal List with Chris Pratt on Amazon, we got a bunch of those books together, and we put them up on the, and I actually took a bunch of books off my shelf and I put them in a box and I sent them out to Amazon, and then they picked ones, or the when we were doing the opening credits, there's another company that you hire to kind of do just focus on opening credits, and
Yeah.
so we got them arranged on the shelf, and as the opening credits go, it pans a bookshelf.
Wow, that's so cool. Yeah, your influence, you see it all the way through. It's like the things that have lit you up, and there's a lot. So I love that. And my husband, his name's Josh, he loved all the gear references. And I know there's the phrase, take care of your gear will take care of you. It's
That's
in the
right.
book, but then it's also in the show. He's like, oh, that's this kind of backpack, and he's got challenge coins, and there's, the Arc'teryx this and the
That
all.
is,
It's great. A black
That's
rifle
good.
coffee is in the book, and are you sort of hand in hand involved with a lot of picking of those types of things?
Yep. So the show is different than the books. Like the book is all 100% me. The show is very collaborative. So there are some differences there. But I've always been a gear person, even before my time in the military. Just as a kid, I was always a gear person. I was fortunate enough to spend a lot of time in the mountains with my family, and so I'm always looking at different backpacks. And I started as a kid with an external frame pack, like you'd see, like you'd picture like a Boy Scout troop going into the mountains with in the 50s or 60s or something. And then in the 80s, things transitioning to that internal frame, and so I got one of those early. Early and just different tents and layering combinations and boots and socks and all that stuff. I was just always interested in that, and I was always not like, oh, this works, I'll just keep doing it. No, I was always interested in, hey, what's coming out next? How are we improving
Yeah.
upon this? And in the military, you do that by a matter of necessity, because you want your guys to have the best gear possible going downrange to get any sort of an advantage you can over the enemy. So it was very natural. And then it continues today. I just happen to be a gear person. So it's very natural to weave gear into my stories. And for me, when I see somebody, like what they're wearing, what they drive, tells me a lot about them. So I use weapons and vehicles too, to tell a story about that character. So they're character development tools. Like if I see somebody that has a leather holster, leather belt, cocked and locked, 1911 45, that tells me something about them, rather than seeing somebody with like a nylon belt, a Kydex holster, a striker fire pistol. It just tells me something about them, age, experience, whatever it might be. So I use those in the novels as well. Yeah. Then when it comes to the show side of the house, you have a prop master, in this case, amazing. He's a third generation prop master, amazing guy, Gary Tours. And so he tries to get as much as close to the book as possible, but then sometimes it's just, you can't for whatever reason. So sure. You put something else in there or whatever else, but we try to, and there's no product placement. Like people talk about product placement and no one's paying to get any product in the show, which I think made this different. Cause it's not like, let me have a drink of my, you know, whatever, Gatorade, Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or whatever it might be. It's like, we put things in there that develop the character. So if it's not to develop that character in the way that makes sense, then there's no sense to have it in there. So there was no paid product placement in the show, just like there's not in the novels. It's all just stuff that I want to put in there.
But those companies must think that's the coolest. And that's what it seems like. It just seems like, oh yeah, of course. Of course that James Reese is going to have that backpack and that type of thing. And, you know, it's cool stuff. Like there was one scene where he breaks into the house and then he's downloading stuff from the computer and then he sets the computer back. And in some way he like puts it in the exact same spot, the right exact angle. You know, this is really cool to see all this stuff.
Yeah. There's an actual app out there that lets you. So if you go into your like a hotel room, essentially, you can take a picture of certain things. And then when you come back in, you line that back up. And if you see something that's ajar, then you know someone has been in there messing with your stuff. So we put that in as well. Just makes sense.
Yeah, so many cool things to learn. And I was just really thinking about the bravery, really a combination of the bravery and the brilliance. In the book, In Only the Dead, I love the dialogue that James Reese has with himself all the way throughout. And one of the words that he is having with himself is adapt, you know, the exclamation point. And so just thinking about today's generation, and I just talked to this woman who is a reigning expert on generational change. Her name is Dr. Jean Twenge, and she teaches at a university, and she says kids are coming in and they are less and less able to make even simple decisions without texting their parents. So then you watch your show, you watch The Terminalist, or you read a book like this, and you see this just like quick mind, quick adaptation. How many bullets? Tell me's in the magazine. How many people are still here? What am I going to do? It's dark. I have to improvise. I'm in the water. And it just made me think about what type of childhood contributes to a soldier like that?
Yeah, I don't know. I think everybody comes from a different. That's what I loved about the SEAL teams, is that everybody brought so many different things from their backgrounds to it. It wasn't like just a person from a certain area of the country with a certain like socioeconomic background that's now in the SEAL teams. It was amazing. You had Rhodes Scholars who were officers. You had Rhodes Scholars who were enlisted. You had people who had never seen the ocean before. You had people who had grown up on the water. You had people from all these different areas of society, and all came together. And those different backgrounds really allowed us, I think, to problem solve creatively and aggressively on the battlefield, because we all did bring something different. And then we all had this same experience called BUDS, Basic Underwater SEAL Training, which is our SEAL training pipeline. So now, even though we had all came from all these different places, we all come together and we have this shared experience, not just as a class, but we share that in common with people who went through training 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 20 years ago, or that'll go through tomorrow. So we all have this shared experience together to move forward, but we're all bringing those different backgrounds together, kind of a different way of maybe thinking about things, different life experiences, different things that you're good at, things that you need to work on, but y'all come together as a team and have this thing called team ability, which is not really a word, we had to make it up, and allows you to be something greater than oneself because of all these other inputs that you have in order to solve problems that you have to solve very quickly and very aggressively and very creatively on a battlefield, because the enemy is certainly adapting to you and trying to do it quicker than you can adapt to them. So it's always about looking for gaps in the enemy's defenses, looking for ways to capitalize on momentum you might have, but it's really a game of constant adaptation. So that's what I love the most about the SEAL teams. I think when I look back on it, is all those different people coming together with a common mission to solve problems.
Wow. So the foundation happens there. It happens with the team. You use the phrase aggressive problem solving. your sixth sense, all these things that you look and you can't even really imagine. It's hard to even watch, truthfully. It's scary to watch. And then you think, well, what if you are actually there? What if you're actually running through the sewer and there's tripwire and you're having to drag someone with you and people are firing guns? It's just one thing to even be able to watch it, but another thing to actually be there. And so what you're saying is this learning to be comfortable with the uncomfortable, you know, the heart of a warrior is happening in that camaraderie team environment through training.
Hair thinning is complicated. The problem is it's actually much bigger than your hair alone. Like your skin, hair is a reflection of your health, and internal factors can impact the way your hair looks, feels, and grows. Nutrafol's whole body approach multi-targets underlying root causes like stress, hormone fluctuations, and nutrient gaps for visibly thicker, stronger hair. Nutrafol is the number one dermatologist recommended hair growth supplement, with over 1 million people seeing thicker, stronger, faster growing hair with less shedding. While many supplements rely solely on ingredient studies, Nutrafol clinically tests final formulations to ensure their efficacy. In a clinical study, 86% of women reported improved hair growth after taking Nutrafol Women's Hair Growth Supplement for only 6 months. Take the first step to visibly thicker, healthier hair. For a limited time, Nutrafol is offering our listeners $10 off your first month subscription and free shipping when you go to Nutrafol.com and enter the promo code OUTSIDE. Find out why over 4,500 healthcare professionals and hairstylists recommend Nutrafol for healthier hair. Nutrafol.com is spelled Nutrafol.com. Promo code is OUTSIDE. That's Nutrafol.com. Promo code OUTSIDE. We love bread in our house. I mean, who doesn't? PB&Js, turkey sandwiches, even just morning toast with butter. It's all good in our home. We're always on the hunt for a healthy alternative. That's why our family loves Hero Bread. It is delicious. They make delicious bread and products free of consequences or compromise. They've made carby, empty calorie bread products into fluffy, delicious versions that include no net carbs, 0 grams of sugar, and fewer calories, plus protein and fiber. We love the classic white bread and the seeded bread, which are both made with olive oil and have a wonderful, rich taste to them. I was so surprised how soft both types of bread were. They were just the right blend of chewiness and sturdiness for making sandwiches. This bread is a favorite in our house for sure. The tortillas were also delicious, and we loved making simple cheese quesadillas as a snack. We're talking zero net carbs, high in fiber, 0 grams of sugar. What more could you ask for? Hero Bread is offering 10% off your order. Go to hero.co and use code OUTSIDE at checkout. That's code OUTSIDE at hero.co.
That's right. And then through multiple new shared experiences in combat downrange, you know, some that are successes, some that are failures, but you're continuing to build and take lessons learned and apply them going forward as wisdom, which hopefully we're all doing in life. But I feel extremely fortunate to have gone through that experience with such an amazing group of people. And today it's not much different what I'm doing, although the consequences of messing up on the page are a lot less dire than messing up in Iraq or Afghanistan under fire. But essentially I'm problem solving on the page, and I get to a part and okay, I'm going to solve this creatively. My protagonist is going to solve it creatively and most likely aggressively because of who he is. But you know what, if I can't quite figure it out, I don't need to make a decision right now because it's on the page and people's my right and left are not relying on me to make a decision that that might affect the rest of their lives or that sort of a thing. So it's so I can sleep on it and then I can't quite figure it out. You know, I can keep moving with the story and then I can come back to it because I have a year and a half to figure this out. And I know that along this journey, I'll be able to figure this out and then I'll come back and weave something in there that makes sense and is fun for readers. So it's the same, but it's different because of the consequences.
Well, that's interesting, though, because like you said, you have 18-month runway and it's ripped right out of today's headlines. You know, I open the book and it's Ukraine, it's China, it's Taiwan, it's the microchips. It's super interesting because then, you know, you're reading and then for me, I'm like, is this real? Is this not real? In some ways, you're making some predictions. Does that part make you nervous at all that you're going to get it totally wrong or you just go for it?
Yeah, I just go for it because you don't really have a choice. You eventually have to go for it. Yeah. But some things aren't that hard to predict, like Russian invasion of Ukraine. I put that in my second novel that came out in 2019. So some things like that, like they're just probably going to happen. And based off, you know, populations and that sort of thing, in this case, ethnic Russian population in such a steep decline that they need Ukraine if they're going to survive with an ethnic Russian population that allows them to move forward. And they can only staff really a military up to a certain point, and then they're going to have to invade Ukraine. But so that's going to have to change when we actually make the show with Chris Pratt, because now it's actually happening in the book, you know, of course, the protagonist. Thing. And but now we have to make a couple changes there. And there's always going to be changes between a book and something that's a storytelling visually on the screen. There's things that have to change. And that's fine. That's how it goes. But I love doing all this research. And then now I do an author's note. So I didn't for the first three books. And then when I did The Devil's Hand, my fourth one, I went so deep down the rabbit hole into bioweapons research, what the government calls biodefense research. But it's bioweapons research, and just went so down the rabbit hole there. I realized when I got to the end that people were going to have questions about, hey, what was real and what wasn't, and what I just read. So I wrote an author's note there, and then that continued with the next one, In the Blood, where I went deep down the rabbit hole into artificial intelligence and quantum computing. And I also realized at the end of that one that people were going to have questions about what was real and what was fact and what was fiction. And so I did that then, and I did it again in this book right here. Yeah. I start off with a preface that in the beginning that kind of sets the tone for what's to come. And then at the end, I have the author's note that talks about what was fact and what was fiction. So I like kind of booking the story like that.
I was thrilled to get to that part because I had a running list. I had a running list of real or not real. And then I hit the end and you hit so many of them. The secret cities in the Soviet Union, which that reminds me of the Hunger Games, the different Crazy. Cities for this one's for scientists. And this one's, I mean, wow, this one's for nuclear. It's so interesting. Photography was banned. You touched on Abel Archer at the end, the prisoners of war, the Operation Homecoming. So it was interesting. I wanted to know if you have an aversion to mayonnaise.
I was taking a sip of coffee right there. Yes, disgusting. I'm sorry. Like mayonnaise out there, but mayonnaise, sour cream, like, ugh. Yeah. No.
That was what I was wondering. Real or not real?
Real.
The mayo is real. What about real. All plutonium has a signature? That's real?
That is real. That is real.
Was the water your favorite part of Buds?
Did I say it was my favorite in there?
Well, you said it was his favorite. It was his favorite. So I didn't know if that was your favorite or if it was his favorite.
No, I mean, I always liked the water, free diving for abalone. I got my scuba diving thing really early in life. And I don't think you could do that today for some reason, how my dad talked them into letting a 9-year-old get certified as a scuba diver back in the day, which was maybe a little early when I look at 9-year-olds, especially going down to 100 feet. I don't know how my mom let me do that. But some parts of Buds, so being comfortable in the water for me in Buds was something that was, yes. I don't know if I looked forward to it, but I was definitely comfortable in the water, especially when it came to like ditching and donning your gear but I really liked, and maybe this is I think this is what you're talking about, that one of the only times in Buds where you get to go one-on-one with an instructor is during some of these water evolutions. So most of the time, you know, you're just getting yelled at, you're doing push-ups, you have a boat over your head, you have a log over your head that you're running down the beach with, you're running the obstacle course, you're going to swim out in the ocean, a 2-nautical-mile ocean swim for time, or a 3-mile beach run or whatever. So you're doing these things, but you're not like up against anyone but yourself. It's all about you finding that mental fortitude and grit and digging down deep and pushing yourself farther than you possibly could and proving that you have the grit and the mental fortitude to be there and be a part of this organization. But there are a couple times where you get to go one-on-one with the instructor. And one of those is called life-saving, where they have different instructors that are playing like somebody's just floating there in the water and you have to go save them. Someone's combative in the water. And of course the combative person is like the biggest Buds instructor they could possibly put there, but you get to go hands-on with them. And I'd been doing Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu early on, so I was kind of comfortable in these situations. And even though it's the water and the other is the mat, but still knowing that when I grab this big instructor, he's going to drag me to the bottom. He's going to bounce me off the bottom. He's going to be exerting and I can fight there, or I can just hold on. just like you would on the mat somewhere if you get in a certain position. So I'm just going to hold on here. He's working hard. So he's going to have to come up for air before I will. And then sure enough, he works too hard. I'm just kind of holding on. He comes up to get a breath. I get a breath. I get a couple more strokes closer to the side of that pool. And then he goes down again and does the same thing. And I get to hold on. So I love that. And then pool comp. Pool comp is in second phase, which is dive phase, when you're showing them you passed first phase, you passed hell week, showing that kind of you have the mental fortitude to be there. And now you have to show that you're comfortable in the water. So you're crawling along the bottom of the pool with your two twin 80s tanks on. And for those listening, it's like if you saw a picture of Navy divers in the 1950s, it's kind of like the same thing, like the two big tanks. Hoses that come around to the front, and then the instructors come down and they rip that hose out. They turn off your air. They slam you against the bottom. They give you, a little jab to the ribs, make you exhale some air, essentially put you in a stressful situation. Also knowing that you have to go through these different procedures in the right order to get going again. And then you start moving and then they hit you again. So they do that for about 15 minutes, but you're showing that you're not going to panic down there without oxygen. You're going to be able to get that oxygen back on. You're going to be able to undo these knots and go through by the numbers, essentially. So I love that, because in both of those, in the life-saving and in pool comp, it was like you against the instructor. It was I think the only two times that I can think of where you actually are kind of hands-on with the instructor, and it's like you against them. It's like, okay, let's do this. And yeah. So I really did enjoy that. And both of them happened to be water evolutions. So I like.
Yeah, interesting. So you had your experience as a kid doing scuba, and Reese had his experience as a kid diving with his dad in Kauai, and he, young kid. And then you really sort of see that in the book. And then he said he liked pool comp. He said a lot of good men washed out in pool comp because they could not get comfortable in stressful situations underwater, dreaded by most. Reese's favorite part of Bud's pool comp. So it's cool to see those parallels between you and these characters. Here's another one, real or not real. There will always be a few who rule over the many.
Yeah, I mean, going back in history, that's typically what you see. You see groups of people that need to control larger populations. And we see it today. I would say that's true. I don't think that's too subjective either.
Mm-hmm. Well, so you're hitting on a lot of these topics about America, and it's a little scary, I think, to read, and concerning. Obviously, things have been happening for centuries, and this is just the way that the world goes. But is it something that, well, I just think the title of the book is so phenomenal that it comes from that quote that says, "Only the dead will see the end of war," that this is just sort of how it is. But is that something that you wrestle with, sort of the decline of society, the greatest generation is mostly gone? You know, you read a book like this and you're like, how am I supposed to reconcile this with my daily life, basically?
I know it's tough because we're so distracted by so many things these days. And, you know, the kids getting programmed to have 15 second attention spans, essentially. I try to be a good example by putting my phone down when I'm downstairs or and I'm around the kids, so they don't just see me doing this, even if I'm actually doing work, which is what I'm only doing on the phone.
Right.
Still, they can't differentiate that in their mind, you know, like, oh, you know, dad's doing this because it's work. I'm doing this. Okay, why? So I know that they can't really differentiate that. Regardless, you're on a device. So I try to put that down, only use that up here in the office. Eventually, I want to just have it plugged in and treat it like it's 1985. Like it's attached to the wall, even though it's just a cord to charge it. But I think a lot of the things as far as what's happening today is you don't go back in the pages of history to appreciate the options and opportunities that we have here and why we have them and what was sacrificed so that we can have them. Much more comfortable just retweeting something from somebody who also didn't put in the requisite time, energy, and effort that the issue deserves, and instead just retweets and gets upset. And what we do, what I think, a lot of these things only bend the division that is so, when you weaponize social media, which is essentially what it is, it's a tool, and that tool is being used as a weapon, not on all cases, but in a lot of cases. And what does that do? Who does that benefit? Well, politicians, because they can use it to can further divide and galvanize a base, which keeps them in office. And then by these tech companies who may have started out with the goal of advertising and making the world a better place, making money from advertising, and now also a tool to get you to change not just behaviors and not just consumer behaviors, but which you can see fairly easily if you want to, you know, if you look at it, but manipulating thoughts So social media has been turned into a weapon, and now it's been turned into a weapon against the most vulnerable among us, which is our children. So, I try to encourage people to read, to put down the phone, to stop tweeting and start reading, and just go back in the pages of history, because there are so many lessons there that can be applied going forward in the form of wisdom that we don't have to relearn. And we neglect to do that. We tend to think of things in terms of 4-year and 8-year election cycles for the real deep thinkers among us, and not necessarily go back and ask the why and appreciate what was sacrificed so that we do have these freedoms. And really, it's not for us when we go into that, whether it's a voting booth or whether it's a retweet or an argument at work or around the dinner table. You know, we don't really think it's not about us. It's about the next generation, and we're making decisions that are going to impact our kids and grandkids generations going forward. So I think keeping that in mind before we immediately retweet or get angry about something or just take a side because our quote unquote, our side, that's the position of our side, maybe take a breath and think about it a little bit. And I always ask myself, even though it's a little, you know, cynical, is how am I getting manipulated here? How do they want to manipulate me here based on whether it's a news article or a soundbite or whatever it might be, advertisement, who knows? But I was like, why, how are they trying to manipulate me here? Which is kind of the same way to do it, but you're getting so many inputs constantly. And it's not just for your betterment. It's people are trying to manipulate you. Corporations are trying to manipulate you. Governments are trying to manipulate you, whatever it might be. So I think put the phone down and get back to reading.
Yeah. I mean, that's really actually a fantastic answer, because it permeates your book too. And it's really neat to have this thriller. I mean, it's a page turner for me as a woman, and maybe this wouldn't be the case for every woman. At the beginning, I asked my husband a lot about, I had to read him several passages for a bit of time to have a better understanding of the background. And then I got to the spot where they were at Poe's, his compound where he has his house and he's got his dogs and there's other house. And I got to that point. And at that point, from there on out, so if people are picking it up and maybe they're like me and don't have quite as much of the background, but you do have a really good glossary too in the back. So if there's things that people don't totally understand, they can go back. But I got this is a page turner, right? It's a page turner from there all the way to the end. What's going to happen? It's all these different storylines. It's exciting, but then it really gives you a lot to think about. And I think just from the fact that you're reading a long book is helping with your attention span, and that there's a rabbit trail of books where you're going through all these other, you know, it sparks your interest. So I could read this book, I could read that book. And then you're thinking, like you had this quote in there, it was such a huge one. I pray that those with stars on their collars have studied their history. Wow, that's good stuff. He wondered what they would think of generations that inherited the gift of freedom for which they had sacrificed so much. Just so many thought-provoking things in there beyond the thriller, beyond the entertainment and the character development and all of that, there's a lot. So one of the things that you talk about in there is veterans. It made you think about these prisoners of war who got left, or, you know, and the veterans that come home. And you do a lot with veterans. So I would love to hear a little bit about that, the Rescue 22 Foundation.
Yeah. So there's a few different foundations that I have personal touch points with, and most every foundation that I talk about on social media or weave into the storylines in some cases are places that I didn't just Google and say, oh, I need a veteran organization that deals with dogs or, you know, whatever. It's some place that I have a personal touch point with because friends are involved in it, or I've done something with them or whatever it might be. But jumping back to those quotes earlier, some of our senior military leaders and politicians, they give me a lot to work with when it comes to developing the antagonists, just because of that line you just read right there. And I think that's why you didn't need any sort of a military background, or you didn't need to have ever read a book on strategy or tactics, or even know someone in the military, or even seen a military movie to look at the withdrawal from Afghanistan and say, could we have done that a little better?
Right, because then you talk about it slipped in there, but they're wearing the night vision goggles and the M4s, and you know they're wearing the American, like that part of it. So that was slipped in there, and yeah, it you know what? It's such a good point, because I haven't obviously. I mean, I would tend toward a different type of genre of book, but I love to learn and I love to read and I love to grow. So I was so thrilled to get this book, and I'll go back and read the other ones. But you are absolutely right. You didn't even have to read the first five to jump into Only the Dead and get so much out of it and be super entertained, but also to get your mind spinning about just different things in our world. So yeah, I totally agree with that.
Yeah, I liked books growing up that would leave us like a sentence in there that was just an enthralling sentence, but it wouldn't follow up on it. It would be kind of like, oh, wait, I need to be a little smarter, wiser, more well-read to understand exactly what this sentence means. I think I get it because of context, so it doesn't interrupt the flow of the story, but it inspires me then to do more research on my own. So I always love that. So I try to do that.
Yeah, it's there.
But for veterans, yeah, well, I wove into my third novel in particular, Rescue 22 Foundation, which is a organization started by a SEAL buddy of mine that provides fully trained service and support dogs to veterans dealing with post-traumatic stress and traumatic brain injury and physical disabilities as well. There's that. And then kind of a tie-in to this past generation, there's an organization called the Best Defense Foundation. And they do a lot of things, but one of the things they do is bring World War II veterans back to the battlefields on which they fought for some final closure. And my daughter, she's 17. Well, the first time we did one, she was 16. And we took 62 veterans back to the 80th anniversary, the commemoration events at Pearl Harbor. So she's there. And it was life-changing for her to sit across the table from people who had fought in World War II and to hear their stories and to be so interested in it. She's not on her phone. You know, she's just learning these stories and she's helping getting them in and out of their wheelchairs, on and off the buses to these different events, making sure they're taking their medicine, making sure they get to their rooms. So she got to hear stories. And then we went back to Normandy a few months later, and she got to stand on the beach with someone who had been in the first wave across that same beach in World War II. And she's standing there on the beach looking at the waves, and he's describing to her where he ran and where he went up. And it was just absolutely incredible. So Best Defense Foundation does that, but that's a touch point with history that she'll have. And it's important to get in the pages of books. And I think historical fiction is a good way kind of to introduce people, because it's not dry. You're looking at history typically through the eyes of a person or a family in some cases, but you're learning this history that way. And if it's World War II, it's maybe The Winds of War or Mourn Remembrance by Herman Wolke, are a great, great way to take you from the pre-World War II all the way through World War II through a multi-generational family. So it's really amazing. But she got to sit and talk to these guys and be across the table from someone who was on the airfield at Pearl Harbor, who saw these planes come over the mountains and drop down and then strafe the runway, the first shots of Pearl Harbor. And he jumps into this, what was then a sewage ditch. Now it's just a dry ditch. And then he jumps up and runs to the edge of the water and watches them bank, turn, and then drop the first torpedoes on Pearl Harbor. And unfortunately, he just passed away recently, over 100 years old. Jack Holder is his name. And then he went on to become a pilot of a PBY, which is a float plane, for those listening, that would drop torpedoes. And he sunk a Japanese submarine in the Pacific, helped sink a Japanese aircraft carrier in the Pacific, and then went to the Mediterranean and sunk a Nazi submarine. Like, amazing. And then he never talked about it until about 10, 15 years ago. It is just incredible. But she got to hear that from him before he passed away. And now she's on the phone, FaceTiming and texting and calling some of these guys age like 95 to 104. And it's a really, really special thing for her to be able to do. So Best Defense Foundation is an amazing organization.
Well, it's our last chance.
Yeah.
It's our last chance to talk to some of these who served.
It's no secret. We love music in our household. And music lessons don't need to be expensive, boring, or stressful. Vogtberg Music Academy offers online lessons that siblings can share in the comfort of your own home. Instead of dragging kids to lessons and paying hundreds of dollars a month for one student, use my code OUTSIDE to get 50% off the first month when your children learns piano, fiddle, guitar, mandolin, or ukulele at vogtbergmusicacademy.com. For only $15, get weekly lessons and practice principles, 24/7 access to your instructor, live student onboarding calls, and video vaults that provide dozens of extra lessons for students who want to progress faster. With Vogtberg Music Academy, you will never have to nag your children to practice as they work toward earning badges on their success path and performing for community student showcases. Once again, use my code OUTSIDE to give it a try. You get 50% off this month and give your children a lifelong love of music at vogtbergmusicacademy.com. That's spelled V-O-E-T-B-E-R-G musicacademy.com. And use code OUTSIDE when you sign up. I'm thirsty.
Just think how many times you hear that when you're at the sports field with your kids or out on a hot summer hike or just driving around in the car. Water is obviously a go-to, but have you ever thought about healthy hydration? Element is a zero-sugar electrolyte drink mix born from the growing body of research revealing that optimal health outcomes occur at sodium levels 2 to 3 times government recommendations. Electrolyte deficiency or imbalance can cause headaches, cramps, fatigue, brain fog, and weakness. Element helps anyone stay hydrated as each stick pack delivers a meaningful dose of electrolytes free of sugar, artificial colors, or other dodgy ingredients found in popular electrolyte and sports drinks. That's why Element is trusted and used by everyone from the Olympic weightlifting team, NFL and NBA players, Stanford neuroscientists, and everyday moms like me. Our kids actually fight over them. We keep the stick packs with us when we are on the go. They're super convenient. Head directly to our exclusive page at drinklmnt.com/1000hours to receive a free Element sample pack with any order. That's drinklmnt.com/1000hours to get your free sample pack with your order. We went to the Pearl Harbor. We were there earlier this year, and I'd been once before with my grandma a few decades back, but what a place to go. And I didn't realize that they were under, the government came and took over. It's different places where, you know, they took over this land or that land, and the kids are carrying gas masks to school, and everyone was stockpiling food. It's a reminder that even if things feel scary, things have always felt scary, I think. There's always been these unknowns, and that's a consistent part of history, which is why you have the quote, "Only the dead have seen the end of war." It's this such a fantastic title of a book, "Only the Dead." It's incredible. So great to learn about these different foundations. I was curious who Thomas M. Rice is that you dedicated the book to.
He's one of those World War II veterans that my daughter met at Pearl Harbor. And he was born in Coronado, California, which is also one of the hubs for the SEAL teams. And we lived there for all of these years, and we'd never met him. And then we meet him at Pearl Harbor. And then we go to Normandy also with him. And he jumped into Normandy. He jumped into Market Garden. My daughter got to hear these stories directly from him. And then he passed away this past year, this past November. And we went out to Coronado, California for his memorial. So my daughter and I were right there in this church that he frequented in Coronado, California there that we'd been by, I mean, every day, essentially, her early life that we lived in Coronado for. So just that he was the first guy in his stick out. That means you're the first person to jump for those listening. So.
Oh, wow. Yeah. First in his stick out.
Yeah. They have like 5 jumps and people are like, oh, only 5. Yeah. But they were Normandy, they were Market Garden. They were like all these jumps before too. But it's just amazing, amazing person.
Wow. So you have your podcast, Danger Close, new episodes every Wednesday, almost 200 episodes. And you've had some cool people on there. Stephen Pressfield's been on several times. We talked earlier about Brian Moore. Chris Pratt obviously has been on. We talked about David Morrell, the Able Archers, though. I'm excited to listen to that one. David Morrell, Michael Easter. We've had on Michael Easter, Oliver North. So tell us a little bit about the podcast. Is it hard to narrow down who to have on?
If now it is, because now you have one, now you're established, and you know, people can look and be like, oh, this is one I should do if they're getting a lot of requests, type of a mm-hmm. thing. But initially, I just wanted to do it because I started to get a lot of questions on social media and questions that didn't really lend themselves to one sentence answers. And for those that have ever looked in a comment section on anything from YouTube to Instagram, you realize it's not the best place to have a productive discourse. Mm-hmm. So I was getting, you know, those types of, and usually I use social media to say thank you, and I want to add value to people's lives throughout the year. So I put a lot of thought into social media. As much thought goes into a sentence in a tweet or an Instagram post as goes into a sentence in the novel. So I always want to add value to people's lives because they're trusting me with time that they're never going to get back. So that's something extremely, extremely seriously. So I put a lot of time and effort into that. But the podcast came about because I was like, oh, a much better way to answer some of these questions I'm getting is through a conversation. And so I'm like, oh, I'll just do a podcast. And I heard so many people say, you know, there's no barriers to entry on a podcast. So I said, oh, okay, great. So what do? I'll get this machine here, a video, a camera there. Okay, I get some cards, put those in. I figured out how to press record here and record there. And that was it. It's important to know your limits. questions. And so for me, that was my limitation. So then I got the company that has done the book trailer videos for me for each of my novels, and they were starting up a podcast section. So I was like, okay, let's do this. And so they produce it, meaning they do all the graphics and they do put it all together and they upload it and do all the things that I could never do. So so really all I have to do is research and read and get these questions and then have a conversation. And
it's awesome. It's like what you like anyway. Exactly. It's the best.
And there's a lot of overlap now too. I thought it was kind of going to be like kind of, I didn't realize how much it was going to impact the novel. So I have somebody like on, and he has the Able Archers, and I learn about this incident in 1983 where we almost have a nuclear exchange with the Soviet Union, and there just happens to be this Soviet military officer who's not even supposed to be on watch that night, but who happens to be a thinker, and he happens to be a strategic thinker, and he has studied the United States and studied his own country, and maybe anybody else in that position would have launched because they had launches that weren't real coming from the United States, but their computer was showing that you had these launches. And you just happen to have maybe the one person in the Soviet Union that wouldn't have hit that button that night. So it's a really interesting story. So that, anyway, that made it into the novel. And there's been a few different times where, and it's, you know, I've read every book for people that have come on the podcast thus far. I don't know if I'll always be able to do that because there are a lot of things in the works, but I've done it so far. And because there's so many things going on, I might have lowered the priority of some of these novels or books and not gotten to them. But because the person's coming on the podcast, I've gone in and had these great conversations. And then it's made it into the novel. So, wow. So there is a lot I didn't really anticipate at the outset.
There's more to it than you could ever imagine. It's so cool. So Danger Close has almost 200 episodes on just phenomenal topics. Even, I mean, I think it's cool that you respond to the negative reviews. I think that's something that people fear. I think that's a reason why people don't do things is because of the negative reviews. And so you tackle those head on, and you just have even ideas, movie guides, read guides, gift guides. Like I said, Father's Day is coming up. So that is important, different gift guides. So you have this book that comes out May 16th, and you're going on tour.
Yes. And I love that because it's kind of like social media. It's a way for me to say thank you. Because back in the day, let's say 1985, 1995, 1975, the only time as an author you really got to say thank you was maybe if you got an interview, let's say with like a CBS This Morning type show or something like that. Yeah. And at the end, you could say, oh, and thank you to all my readers. Or at an in-person book signing, you could shake a hand and say, hey, thank you so much. But today, now I can do that on social media. So people... Yeah. Out and say, oh, I love the book, or I, you know, I gave it to my dad and now he's read all of them now. I can say thank you so much. And I use social media for that. And then also on book tour, it's a way to shake hands, take a picture, say thank you, because without people taking a risk on me as a new author and then telling a friend in person or somebody at work or around the dinner table or putting it out there to their 10 followers on social media or 10,000 followers, whatever it is, that's the reason that people are finding out about the novel. So I sincerely appreciate it. And the book's made the New York Times list because of that, well before I was on Joe Rogan or Tucker or before Chris Pratt tweeted or put it on Instagram that we were doing the show. And now I'm so glad, because in the lead up, I was like, man, I wish these guys would kind of say something, and they didn't. And then it made the New York Times list, and then they did. So I'm like, so now I really like that they didn't, because now no one can say the only reason that you're on the list is because of X, Y, or Z. Yeah. And but now I really like that it was grassroots. It was because of readers. As a fans, it was big, that audience, and it was all grassroots, and that means a lot to me.
Mm-hmm. And because people are still reading, I just think that's such a big point too. Like, we have to still be reading. It's such an important thing for our attention span. And so that's fantastic. Okay. So I read somewhere, I can't remember where I found it. It might've been on the sheet that they sent over or somewhere. It said that you have a nonfiction. You're working on a nonfiction as well. And I can't find it in my, I did. Upcoming nonfiction book on 1983 Beirut Barracks bombing.
That's right. So I always wanted to go into the nonfiction space. And I didn't want to write about things I did in the SEAL teams or anything like that, because people did so much more than I could ever have hoped to have done in Iraq and Afghanistan in the SEAL team. So I wanted to explore a terrorist event, because growing up, some of my first memories are of the 1979 Iranian hostage crisis, just because I already knew I was going into the military at that time. I remember Newsweek magazine and Time magazine coming to the house. I remember Walter Cronkite, counting the days that Americans have been held in captivity. So that was very impactful to me. And then I remember the 1983 Beirut barracks bombing. I remember TWA 847. I remember Achille Laurel, Pan Am 103, a series of terrorist attacks in Europe at nightclubs and cafes in the 80s. So all these things were very impactful during that time of my life when I'm also reading these thrillers, when I'm also trying to read all the nonfiction I can on special operations. So Tom Clancy in the 80s, it was all fiction. And then in the early 90s, he started writing nonfiction, and his were books, Air Wing, I think, Carrier, Aircraft Carrier, Tank. So he had these ones on specific aspects of the military, and he'd bring in a subject matter expert to do those with him. So I always knew that one day I would write a nonfiction, and it seemed like now was the right time. There are new classified documents related to the 1983 Beirut barracks bombing that talk about the decision-making process in the Oval Office, who was advocating Marines ashore, who's advocating to keep them on amphib ships in the Med, why these decisions were made. So there's that piece to it. It has a beginning in earlier, but for the story purposes, in April of 1983, where the U.S. Embassy is bombed in Beirut, and then you have these newly declassified documents, and then we get into October, and then October is the Beirut Marine barracks bombing, and then we have a lot of tough talk afterward, and then we slowly leave Beirut afterward. So we teach the enemy a lesson there that terrorism works. And then there's an ending too, in that the guy who planned it ended up being number two at Hezbollah, number one of their militant wing. And he is assassinated in 2008 in Damascus, Syria. And there's still some mystery around who is behind it, but the assassination does bear the hallmarks of perhaps a joint U.S. Mossad operation, U.S. technical intelligence and Mossad proxy force, probably. So it has that investigative journalist element to it as well. There are people still alive that we're interviewing, and I'm working on it with James Scott, who's a historian, Pulitzer Prize finalist, amazing guy. He has five books, primarily on World War II. So we're working on it together, and it'll come out in fall of 2024.
Wow. Oh, that's awesome. I love all the parallels between the book. Like when you talk about James Reese and you talk about, well, you just talk about in general, the heart and mind of a warrior. So this is right in the very beginning. You say a warrior, a hunter, a protector, and student, always a student. He is constantly learning along his journey, arming himself with the tools he needs to prevail when the chips are down. And so you talk about small victories. These are just really cool things in life, but then you're doing it. You're always a student. You're learning how to write a new type of book. And so the parallels there, you know, it's one thing to read and have it be this thing out there, but then to see you're doing it and you're continuing to do it. You always have done it since you were a child. And so that is very inspiring. So people can look forward to that. So I'm just going to run through real quick. People can follow you on officialjackcarr.com. The website is fantastic. That's where I found those book lists. Information for the podcast is there. All your books are there, 6 books. You're on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at JackCarrUSA. And then you also have the book club. People got to be reading, right? We got to keep that attention span.
That's right. I try to encourage reading constantly, any chance I get, talk about reading and books. But yeah, being a student, I felt like I was just been a student my whole life. The day I left the SEAL teams, I feel like I was as much of a student as the day that I got there. I always wanted to make myself a better operator, a better leader. And I want to make myself, yes, a better author, better writer, but also a better husband, better father, just always trying to improve in all aspects of life. That's something that I do think about every day.
Yeah, you're going for it. You're the executive producer of a television show. So The Terminalist is on Prime. And then is this one coming out, Only the Dead? I thought I saw a trailer for that.
So people do think the trailers are. So I have book video trailers that look a lot like movie trailers.
Okay.
I do that because they're elevated. Like,
yeah, it's so cool.
But so the next one we're doing is a spinoff from one of the characters in the first novel. Mm-hmm. So it'll have an origin story, and that's going to star Taylor Kitsch, and Chris Pratt is in 3 of those 7 episodes. We were writing that until about 4 days ago when the writer's strike hit. So now it's pencils down on that. So now I shift focus back to book 7 into the nonfiction series while the writer's strike.
Adapt.
Exactly. Right? Adaptation. Exactly. So the first one's a spinoff, and then the next one will be True Believer, starring Chris Pratt.
So Terminalist, 1.6 billion streaming minutes in the first full week on air. Unbelievable. So people can check that out. I mean, yeah, you just have all of these things going on. And then obviously the Danger Close podcast, Beyond the Books with Jack Carr, 200 episodes, just fantastic, interesting topics from all sorts of different things. Leadership is in there. And, you know, like I said, Michael Easter and the
psychology of being uncomfortable and all that. So just a whole rabbit hole, Jack Carr rabbit hole to dive down into, but things that really are enhancing in life. And I just so thoroughly enjoyed the book. Like I said, a page turner, but left me with a lot to think about. And I also learned a lot. So I love books like that. So I'm just thrilled to have met you. What an honor and what a treat to have read your book. We always end our podcast, Jack, with the same question. And the question is, what's a favorite outdoor memory from your childhood?
Ooh, I have quite a few. So I'm lucky that I have quite a few. I'm going to go, I want to tell you like five right now, but I think maybe a water slide in the backcountry with my parents and family, a natural water slide. Wow. So a little bumpy, but in the Sierras. So I think I'm going to go with that because there's nobody around, you're out there, fresh air, mountains, beautiful, the sounds, I remember the sounds, the cold water, how cold that was from that alpine runoff. And so I think I'll go with that one.
Well, thank you. Thank you for your service. Thank you for your fantastic books and all these other things that you are doing to inspire us to always be students, to keep reading, to be better versions of ourselves. And congrats. Congrats on a new book.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me on. I sincerely appreciate it. This was so much fun.
Oh, hey, everybody.
It's us, Blair and Molly, your old pals from Toddler Purgatory. Two moms who are also actors, who are also creative beings, who sometimes feel stuck.
And this is our new podcast, Unsticking It with Blair and Molly. What happens when your creative spark just seems to disappear? Gone.
Poof. Bye.
See ya. What happens when life gets in the way of your creativity instead of nourishing it? That's what happened to Molly and me. We felt like the thing that drove us creatively stopped working and impending doom had in fact impended.
Totally. So we decided to do something about it. And that was steal ideas about getting unstuck from the most creative people we can find. We talked to guests about how to break through the mucky, gluey, sticky wall that can get between you and your creativity. We hear about their journeys, their successes, their challenges, and even their bougie coffee shop orders.
And we're not just talking Bob Ross type paint on paper artists here, though we talk to them too. We're talking to actors, creative directors, dancers, and people who are working hard to be their best creative selves in a world that can sometimes feel real uncreative.
We all have something to teach each other, so let's steal their ideas together.
Join us, won't you, as we deep dive into how to unstick ourselves from the life gunk that can get in the way of our creative freedom. Pandemics, school calendars,
world events, lack of sleep. Oh, get out of there, life gunk.
And let's get back to your best creative self. Subscribe to Unsticking It with Blair and Molly.
You're not going to want to miss an episode.
Unsticking It with Blair and Molly, because sometimes life sucks. Unsticking.